Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, a very warm welcome in. I'm Dave Williams, and you're listening to Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio. You can get in contact with us in the usual way. It's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. And stay tuned for the very latest in accessible technology interviews, reviews, and information that you can use. Coming up this time on Tech Talk, we'll be hearing from Richard Orme from the DAISY Consortium, talking about accessible publishing and also an app for Windows to help you stay in the view of your webcam so that we as blind and partially sighted people can fully participate in all those online video conferences. That's all coming up this time on Tech Talk. Now, joining me as ever to listen to all of that is Tasneem Arshad and Callum Stoneman. Hello, welcome in both. Tasneem, you have to read a lot for your studies and so on.
I do, yes. And generally, that's kind of done electronically with JAWS or with a human person. But if it's leisure reading, then it's definitely Audible and Kindle for me. I find them really accessible and totally love those apps.
And Callum, I imagine in your job, you probably have to go to quite a few online meetings.
Oh, yeah. Pretty much every meeting we have at the minute is virtual. So, and I don't know about you guys, but I hate having the camera on as a blind person. I just don't bother with it. So this sounds very interesting.
Okay, so accessible publishing and staying in the picture in those online meetings. That's coming right now on Tech Talk. By now, we're all used to speaking to our smart speakers, but did you know you can speak to your screen reader? Here's Tasneem to tell us more.
I'd like to introduce you to one of JAWS' brilliant voice assistant features, which is available in the 2019 version onwards. It's a fairly new feature, which is not as comprehensive yet as Lady A or Mr. G, but hopefully in the future, who knows, this may well develop. So, how do you activate the voice assistance, which has an absolutely amazing name? So we can use the wake word, which I will introduce in a second, from your Windows machine. There isn't a specific activation apart from the wake word, which is inbuilt. So there isn't something that you have to manually activate. So you can either use the wake word or you can use a JAWS layered command, which is Alt spacebar and insert pressed simultaneously. So you can do that, or you can use the wake word, but you do have to be quite forceful when using the wake word. So let's test out a couple of things to see what it does. Sharky, what's the time?
2051.
Sharky, tell me a joke.
What is an alien's favorite computer key? The space key.
Not bad for the jokes, but wouldn't rely on it for its entertainment. Let's test out what else Sharky can do. Here are some hopefully useful commands for you. Sharky, what's the battery and network connection?
Battery 66%, time remaining, colon, 5 hours and 15 minutes remaining, EE-UP-2UWM, internet access.
Sharky, Windows list.
Window list dialog, running applications list box, JAWS professional minimized, 1-1, to move to an item, press the arrow keys.
Sharky, system tray.
Select the system tray icon dialog. Select the system tray icon list box. Notification chevron 1 of 7. To move to an item, press the arrow keys.
And finally, let's ask it what it can do. Sharky, what can you do?
Voice Assistant provides a way to interact with JAWS and Windows 10 using speech input. Supported languages include English, Dutch, German, Spanish, and French. Ask Voice Assistant to help you out with various JAWS features using natural speech. This means that the same JAWS action can be performed by more than one similar phrase instead of a single predefined voice command.
Okay, I'm going to pause it there to allow you to digest, and I would love to hear your thoughts on Sharky and how you use it. Please do get in touch on techtalk@rnib.org.uk.
Callum, do you use voice control?
I do, yeah. I mean, I think we've been a little bit spoiled by the amount that voice control can do in a way. And I remember being a little bit underwhelmed when I used this. But I think once you just accept that this isn't voice control of your computer as such, it's voice control of JAWS. This is actually really powerful. I mean, it's so much easier to remember a voice command than, you know, JAWS key plus space plus T plus down arrow plus page up to do something, you know. And I think for new users, this would be really, really useful.
Tasneem, is this a gimmick or is this something that you think you would be using long term?
I think that it's kind of in development at the moment. So really looking forward to, you know, more updates about it. And it's definitely good, as Callum said, for new users and for people who have difficulty with memorising all of the, you know, shortcuts, because there are millions and billions of those and no one's ever going to know every single one of JAWS. So the fact that there is an inbuilt voice assistance, I think, is an amazing feature, and I'm really looking forward to its growth.
You're so right. I've got keystrokes coming out my ears. Callum, Tasneem, thanks very much.
If you have a technology question, why not ask the Tech Talk team? Email now, techtalk@rnib.org.uk, or tweet RNIB Radio using the hashtag AskTechTalk.
When I was growing up, I was very lucky to attend a school that had a well-stocked Braille library. And later, I started using RNIB's Talking Book service. But one organisation whose mission is to make every book accessible for anyone with a print disability is the DAISY Consortium.
Hi, I'm Richard Orme. I work at the DAISY Consortium. That's an international non-profit organisation whose mission is to make information accessible to people with disabilities.
And when you visit the DAISY website, Richard, it says that DAISY kind of exists to really promote the best ways to read and publish. What does that mean?
Well, there are lots of ways that publications are produced. And increasingly these days, people are producing digital publications. But, you know, just like websites and apps and all sorts of products, it's possible to make products and solutions that are not accessible to everyone. And so what we produce are guidelines, tools, standards, techniques that enable publishers of books, magazines, journals, newspapers to ensure that they can be read by people with print disabilities. That's people who are blind, low vision, or who have other disabilities that make it difficult for them to read regular print.
And where did the DAISY Consortium come from?
The DAISY Consortium was formed from a group of special organisations that were running libraries for people with blindness and low vision and other print disabilities, and disability organisations, all coming together to look at collaborating to produce the next generation of talking books. This was at a time when libraries were distributing content on tape, and they wanted to take advantage to new technologies such as the CD offered to them. This is back in the 90s.
And you're quite busy. Like I look at your events calendar and you've got a lot going on. What would you say have been the DAISY Consortium's greatest achievements to date?
Well, I think we're having some great achievements right now. We work in three main domains. One is to support those special libraries and organisations creating accessible reading like RNIB with its talking book service. These kinds of organisations exist around the world, and we help them by working with them to produce tools and technologies to enable them to do their work. These organisations are producing fantastic leisure reading, educational materials, reference materials, and I think we've played a major part in making sure they have the tools and solutions for them to do that. The second domain is bringing accessible reading to parts of the world that don't have it. There are many countries that don't actually have these reading services that we enjoy in the UK. And imagine going to school and not having access to the textbooks that you're supposed to study with, trying to succeed at university, in the world of work, or just to participate in society if you can't read the same books and get access to the same information as people who don't have a print disability. Just this week, we're delivering training in Ouagadougou in Burkina Faso. I've been speaking with an organisation in the Middle East today, putting together training for publishers across Africa. And so one of our big achievements is the work we've done in the last few years, enabling accessible reading in countries for whom they always believed it was something that was only for the rich, industrialised countries. And then the third, and possibly, although it's hard to compare, our greatest achievements is enabling mainstream publishing to create accessible publications. We say that when books are born digital, when they're made as digital books, which is the case these days, they should also be born accessible. And, you know, that's going gangbusters.
You mentioned Burkina Faso. Just give us a bit of a picture of what the experience is like for somebody who is blind or partially sighted growing up in that country. You've been to visit, right?
I have. I had a wonderful week in the capital city there, working with an Austrian non-profit organisation and the National Blindness Organisation, UNABEPAM. Burkina Faso is in West Africa. It's one of the countries in the world with the least resources, with the shortest life expectancy, and with the lowest literacy levels. So the life for someone who is blind or low vision is quite limited, and many folk with disabilities don't even get to go to school. And that experience of people with sight loss has got worse, of course, with the pandemic. But because of partnering with these organisations in that country, we were able to help them create accessible versions of the books that they needed for their education. Previously, if they were lucky to go to school, they would sit with someone sighted who would read each page of the book to them. But by using accessible, low-cost technologies, they were able to continue their studies independently, accessing their textbooks through digital audio players, continue their education, and indeed still take their exams. So, I mean, that is enabled by technology, by the hard work of the organisations there. Of course, when it comes to education, by the hard work of the students themselves, but that's something that we're very proud to have played a part in.
So would a blind student be going to school? I've spoken with people from Somalia, for example, where not that long ago they didn't have any formal educational options for blind and partially sighted people.
Yes, this has been a big campaign, actually, of a sister organisation of ours, which is ICEVI, which is the International Council, which is focused on the education of people with disability. And their big campaign has to be ensuring that people with sight loss, children and adults with sight loss, get access to an education. But it's a bit of a chicken and egg, in that if the teachers and parents feel that when the student goes to school, there isn't anything for them to do because the textbooks aren't accessible. And in low and middle income countries, there's much more of a reliance on the textbook itself for the learning. If those textbooks aren't accessible, why would they be expending the resources on that child going to school? So by increasingly making sure that textbooks are accessible to folk with print disabilities, they will attend school, more textbooks become available. And so that's a virtuous circle. There are then role models of students succeeding, even going to university and then becoming leaders in their communities and so on. And that's how a society moves forward.
And how do you persuade publishers that, you know, not only is this the right thing to do, but it makes business sense? And in some jurisdictions, they're legally compelled to make sure their publications are accessible.
Well, you're right, Dave. The law is increasingly helping frame the conversation. In the US, for example, for universities to adopt textbooks on university courses, they require accessible ebook versions of those titles. And it's the same in countries as diverse as Brazil and South Africa also. But, you know, I've worked on accessibility in several industries, you know, in technology itself, telecoms, broadcasting, banking. You know, I do genuinely say this, that the publishing industry is up for this conversation. Their mission is to get their authors read, to get the books out there to the widest audience. So it's not a difficult conversation, usually, to explain how if they make accessible publications, they're making better publications, reaching a wider audience, and the publishers are great partners in this initiative. You know, even in the busiest years, organisations like RNIB can only produce a relative handful of accessible titles, whereas in a single year, the UK publishing industry is producing 188,000 books. That's 20 books every minute. So enabling the mainstream to create accessible titles that can be read by people who are blind, low vision, dyslexic, have a physical disability that makes it hard for them to hold a book or turn the pages, that's the way to get true inclusion in society. And it's not such a hard conversation to have with publishers, actually.
I remember feeling very excited when I received the news that the World Intellectual Property Organization had signed up for this Marrakesh Treaty. Can you just explain for everyone, Richard, what the Marrakesh Treaty is and how that's going?
Sure. Well, the Marrakesh Treaty is a worldwide treaty, and it's one from the UN agency, which is called WIPO, which is all about copyright and intellectual property. That's the I and the P in WIPO. And to date, their treaties were all about protecting intellectual property and copyright. This is the first human rights-based treaty that they kind of looked after, and it was achieved after many years of hard work, campaigning by organisations, including RNIB, who led a lot of the work. What it does is it enables a legal framework for every country to ensure that if publications don't exist in accessible titles, then organisations that are working with and for disabled people can create accessible versions and they're not breaking copyright. We've enjoyed that situation in the UK for over two decades, but that's not the case in every country. And so that just puts in that kind of baseline right, that copyright exception is the technical term for it. The second thing that comes with the Marrakesh Treaty is it means that there's a framework to ensure that accessible titles can be passed across borders. So a book is usually not sold in a single country. And we also know that people with print disabilities exist in every country. So if a book is made accessible in one country, then it will be a terrible waste of resources if it has to be made accessible in a second country for all the work that's involved in creating the Braille, recording the audio, or whatever is being done there. So the Marrakesh Treaty provides this global framework for the exchange of titles across national borders. And that is working incredibly well. It's the fastest treaty from WIPO in terms of it being adopted by many, many countries. And I have just so many examples to tell you of where folk have struggled to get copies of accessible titles. And yet with the Marrakesh Treaty, it exists in another country and they can get it in a matter of moments. I was talking to a friend from the National Library of Congress in the United States the other day, and they've got a great service called the National Library Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. And she was telling me the story about someone who came to them who was at the end of her life, and she wanted to listen to some audiobooks in her native language, which was Finnish. And unsurprisingly, in the US, they don't have so many Finnish language audiobooks in their collection. But because the US is a signatory of the Marrakesh Treaty and Finland is a signatory to the Marrakesh Treaty, they were able to use that legal instrument and get the books to her so she could enjoy those books in the last days of her life. And that's a very powerful story, I think, that shows that the kind of dry legal arguments and the all the campaigning and all that hard work has translated into genuinely real impact for people at a very important time.
We'll be hearing more from Richard Orme of the DAISY Consortium a little bit later on. And of course, still to come is that review of the Can You See Me app on Windows to make sure that we as blind and partially sighted people get our face in the frame for those online video meetings. But joining me now are Tasneem and Callum. I'd like to explore a bit more about your experience of accessing books. Tasneem, you've had to read a lot for your studies. Have you experienced any difficulties finding accessible versions of books that you need to read?
Very interesting. You should ask about that, Dave, because the answer is yes. Throughout my studies, mainly at universities, I would say it's been incredibly challenging. And the timescale it's taken to get anything in an accessible format, even once you've got that then in a PDF document, then trying to access that independently has been really, really tough. And that's been a key barrier, I would say, to my learning and development.
So those books then, the books that you need to read, they're not on Kindle or Google Books?
I think some of them are, but majority of them are not. Certainly not 20 years ago, they weren't. And even more recently, I was at university about 5 years ago, and a lot of the psychology textbooks that I needed to access, I wasn't able to get the PDF documents. The timescale it took was considerable. So it was mainly relying on human reader support. So that made it quite challenging.
Callum, in your experience, is the problem availability, or is it that actually when you get the file, it doesn't always work?
I think a bit of both, to be honest. I think the availability, it can be difficult to find a PDF for a Word version, but even then when you do find that file, the number of times I've come across a PDF and it's just graphic, image, the book is in an accessible format, but there's just nothing there. And even books that you can get from Kindle, you know, even the Kindle app, although the Kindle app is accessible, or same with Apple Books, the content itself still might not be, I found. So it can be, yeah, it's kind of varied.
So Tasneem, what would be your top tips to sort of help people overcome any issues that they might experience?
I think certainly for studying, very effective DSA, Disabled Student Allowance, support in place, getting the reader list in advance, which is normally what I've done, good contacts at the university library. But it all comes down to the publishers, really, whether the library has permission. And then, as Callum says, it's testing out whether, you know, the PDF is accessible. And it's an absolute mission, Dave. In my experience, it's been so mixed. I don't think I've ever had one PDF that's been completely fluid and independent to read. So yeah, lots of obstacles and challenges. And I basically think that human support reading is the best way forward, in certainly in terms of studying and meeting deadlines.
I think as well, just try and take advantage of things like Bookshare. It might be possible that the book that you're after could be on something like Bookshare, or it might be possible to get it uploaded to Bookshare.
Yeah, I mean, as a leisure reader, I mean, I don't have to read for academia, you know, but as a leisure reader, I sort of feel like we've never had it so good. I mean, I remember, you know, 25 years ago, having to take a book and put it onto a flatbed scanner, you know, and use software like Kurzweil, you know, to scan every single page and then have the, you know, screen reader, you know, kind of read it to you. And now, you know, we've got obviously things like RNIB reading services, Bookshare, you mentioned there, Callum, but then, you know, many, many millions of books on Kindle or Google Books or Apple Books are accessible. So I guess for mainstream reading, the situation has improved, but perhaps a little bit more of a mixed bag when it comes to more specialised reading. Is that fair?
I think so. I think it depends on the subject that you're studying. So yeah, very, very subject dependent. And as Callum says, it varies.
Brilliant. Well, we would love to hear your experience of reading, the good, the bad, and the indifferent. Drop us a line and we promise to read it. Techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Techtalk@rnib.org.uk.
You're
You're listening to Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, we're all familiar with video conferencing, or most of us at least. For the last couple of years, it's been pretty much enforced. Microsoft Teams, Zoom, Google Meet, all of those platforms require us to join meetings online. And of course, many of those meetings have a video component to them. So it is crucial that we as blind and partially sighted people to be fully accepted and included in those meetings are able to confidently use our video technology. Now, if you have an iOS device, you'll be familiar with the idea that when you bring up the camera viewfinder, VoiceOver will give you an audio description of what is in the frame. So you might hear something like one face near left edge, that sort of thing. However, up until now, that ability has not been readily available for those of us using Microsoft Windows devices. And somebody who has tackled this problem is Ben Mustel-Rose. Welcome, Ben. Good to have you with us. Just talk firstly a little bit about the problem. You work a full-time job, and I imagine you found yourself in a few meetings where you've not been in shot, or people are telling you to move your camera.
Yeah,
what's that like?
Well, I think like you say, most of us as blind people have had that kind of semi-embarrassing situation where you discover that your colleagues have been talking to your ceiling or a wardrobe. And you know, I'm really lucky that I genuinely don't think any of my colleagues have ever really been too bothered about it. But you always, I don't know if it's just me, but you always wonder in the back of your head, you think, oh, what are they thinking? You know, are they thinking, oh, Ben, you know, he can't even use a webcam properly. And also, even if you do manage to position yourself properly, if you're asking, you know, if you're always having to ask, oh, am I in shot? Am I in shot? Can you see me? If you're the only person that has to do that in that team, it just, I don't know, I just feel a little bit uncomfortable doing it, really.
You're right. It's about appearing to be competent. And if you can't point the camera at your face accurately, then maybe people make other...
What else can't you do?
Yeah. Indeed, people make other assumptions based on that. So you have studied software engineering. You're a professional software engineer. So you decided to apply your skills to this problem.
Yeah. So it started coming to be in around about March 2021, actually. And I was a few weeks away from starting a new job, and I was a little bit worried because I was having to start it in lockdown, and I wanted a bit of a project to keep me distracted from the job, really. And I came up with a few different ideas. I originally wanted to build a wall mountable product recognition device, kind of like Seeing AI or the features that you get on some Alexa devices. Anyway, long story short, I was prototyping it on my laptop and I couldn't get the product recognition to work. And so I thought, oh, what's going on here? So I thought, well, how about I replace it quickly with face recognition code? Then if the face recognition stuff works, I'll know that the rest of my code works. So I did that, and I guess that was the first incarnation of the tool. And we'll get onto the specifics in a bit. But this first version didn't actually tell you where your face was. It just beeped when it saw a face. And I remember the sort of, I don't know if you can quite call it the eureka moment, but I remember running it on my laptop. I looked at my webcam, started beeping, looked away, stopped, looked back at it again, started beeping again. I thought, actually, you know what? Maybe there are some legs to this, because that was the first time that I was independently able to be certain that my face was in view of my webcam on my laptop. And so I sort of messed about with some more prototyping and ended up scrapping the product recognition idea and focusing full time on this. Because like I say, March 2021, so at that point I'd had a year worth of video conferencing fatigue, I guess you might say, experiencing all of the things that we spoke about initially.
So you have developed an app for Microsoft Windows called Can You See Me?
Yeah. So kind of clues in the name, and with a sort of a smidgen of the sort of dry sense of humor there. So Can You See Me is a fairly simple piece of software that helps blind people make sure that our faces are in shot of our webcams before we do things like Zoom or Teams meetings. And now it can give you that in a couple of different levels of detail. So by default, it divides your screen into a 5x5 grid. So you might get feedback like near the bottom and slightly to the left, top right, or just middle. But there are some different levels of detail that you can go into there if you're a bit more of a perfectionist. There are a few different features. It's really useful for photos. So let's say that you need to do a talk and someone wants a headshot that you can use as promo. You can load up Can You See Me, get yourself into position, take a really nice quality photo of your face. It works quite well in locked down environments, so a work or school laptop where you don't have administrative rights, for example. Now, obviously, I'd always suggest that you get permission before you install or try to run software on those kinds of computers. However, once you do have permission, it will most likely just work. And then I think the last thing to say is that it all runs on device. Now, I think when we get into the technicals of products like this, it's often quite easy to end up on some kind of techno rant that no one understands. So I'll keep it really simple. On device, clues kind of in the name, really. All of the processing that it does of the photos that your webcam takes happens on your computer. I'm not sending your face to me. I'm not sending it to another company. I'm not selling it or anything like that. It doesn't leave your computer. And for the technical people out there, it's open source as well if you want to delve into the code and make sure that that is actually what's happening.
So Can You See Me? Obviously, it's screen reader accessible. It's going to work well with NVDA and JAWS or any other screen reader that you might be using. And it will advise about the position of your face in the camera frame. And then you can also take a selfie as well.
Yes. So that's really useful if someone asks you if you can just send them a little photo as maybe a profile picture, or if you are doing a talk. So the basic idea is you get yourself into position and press P, and then it just saves a nice high quality photo up to 1080p, so HD, onto your desktop or wherever you're running Can You See Me from. And you can actually, like I said earlier, you can actually be confident that it is actually a picture of your face and not your ceiling or your chest of drawers or something like that.
Now, you're creating this as an individual and you're essentially giving it away. So it's basically you get pretty much what you get. You're not offering kind of round-the-clock technical support and things like that.
No, so there's a frequently asked questions section on the website, which I hope will be useful to people. And I've really tried to make it as easy to use as possible. When you open up the tool, you get some basic sort of how to use instructions, so you don't have to read the manual, hopefully. I suppose one of the challenges that you can get with software like this is that it doesn't tell you where your face should be. It just tells you where your face is. It's up to you to figure that out. But usually somewhere near the middle is a pretty good start of 10. But I guess what I'd say is if people are struggling with it, it's one of those things that sort of really pays to get to know it in advance. You know, if you've got a 9 a.m. meeting, don't try and use this for the first time at 8:55. Not necessarily because it's hard to use, or at least I hope it isn't hard to use, but you're dealing with some inherently visual concepts which you may never have done before. So definitely try it for the first time in a little bit advance. But I would say, actually, I've been using this myself for a few months now, and once you get used to it, it really is just a case of just putting it on really quickly before your meeting, making sure you're good, and then going. You can, once you get used to it, you can feasibly do, you know, 30 seconds to a minute of checking and then be confident that you are in a good position and then just go into your meeting.
My son's school have been doing online parents' evenings, and myself and my wife have to get in front of the camera to talk to his teachers or hear from his teachers. How does it work with multiple faces? So if we both wanted to be in shot.
So it will tell you whether there are multiple faces. However, at the moment, it will just tell you the first face that it sees. Now, this is maybe a feature for version 1.1. The challenge here with multiple faces is, how do you distinguish between when there are two faces in the shot, or the rare occasions where the tech doesn't work, because none of this artificial intelligence, computer vision stuff, none of this is perfect. So how do you distinguish between when there is actually two faces and when there is almost like a fake face, if you will? So that will work for you. It will tell you that there are two faces. Although you might have to do a little bit of guesswork about where the second face is positioned. But good question.
And in terms of system requirements, do you need a particular, you know, version of Windows or a particular type of laptop or webcam in order to make this work?
So it works on Windows 7 and up. So Windows 7, Windows 8, Windows 10, Windows 11 works with essentially every screen reader that's out there. Also works with refreshable Braille. So depending on your requirements, you can go completely hands-free. I'm sitting in front of my desktop with a pair of headphones at the moment, but there's no reason why you'd have to. You could Bluetooth a Braille display to your laptop and stand further away and control the app using your Braille display. And then the other thing as well is that because it's on device, it doesn't need any kind of funky internet requirements from corporations or anything like that.
Well, fantastic stuff, Ben. Did you sort of do any research, digging around to see if anybody had already done something? It seems such a simple idea, you know, why somebody hasn't come up with it, you know, before. I guess it's the sort of thing you'd actually really like to be embedded as part of the video conferencing software as you connect. Wouldn't it be great to have that right in Teams or Zoom or whatever?
I mean, you know, I'm really glad that I've made this, but actually, and it's funny if you say this because I was going to mention that. What I would really like is for this to get really popular within the community, someone from Microsoft to take note and not include my version in Windows, because they'd be able to do a much, much better job than a, you know, mediocre software engineer that does it in his spare time. But this a feature like this does belong in Windows. It doesn't make sense that a third party has had to come along and make this. Part of the inspiration was from actually something you mentioned earlier, the feature that you get in iOS where you open up the camera app or the FaceTime app and it will tell you roughly where it is. And I know that some people use their iDevices for video conferencing. I'm more of a computer guy myself, and I really wanted something that was kind of like the iOS functionality on Windows, and now here we are. And I think that is one of the nice things, without meaning to boast, about being a software engineer and learning to code, at least to a level where you can prototype these solutions. Because as blind people, we often encounter problems, right? And they're often fairly unique problems to blindness. And it really feels quite powerful to go from encountering a problem and then making a solution to it. It feels really quite profound to be in a position where you can do that. So, you know, for all the people that are out there and thinking about giving this kind of thing a go, I'd really, really recommend it. Not to mention that it's a great skill for your CV as well.
Well, congratulations, Ben. To find out more and to take Can You See Me for a Spin, what do we need to do?
You can go to canyouseeme.app, where you can learn a bit more about the tool and how to use it. You can download it from there as well. And if you are so inclined, you can check out the code on GitHub.
CanYouSeeMe.app, that's .app. Ben Mustel-Rose, software developer. We hope that you'll come back on Tech Talk again. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Ben Mustel-Rose there with his app, Can You See Me? Callum, this must be a situation that you face regularly. And I think you mentioned earlier that, you know, as a blind person, if you've got the option of not using the camera, you tend not to.
Yeah, I do. Because, I mean, I remember when I first started work, and this was 2020, so everything was virtual. And, you know, we hadn't met anyone in person. So all your introduction calls were all, you know, oh, put your cameras on, let's have a look at, put a background on and, you know, put this and do that. And I didn't really participate in it. And I remember one of the first calls that I did try putting my camera on was with, we had like a Q&A session with some of the seniors, you know, senior managers and senior leaders. And I thought, okay, I'll make an effort with this one. I'll put the camera on. So they threw to me and I'd felt my laptop and felt where the camera was, felt what I thought was, you know, where my face was, and just kind of did a best guess. And as soon as they came to me, first thing I said was, right, just so you know, I'm blind. If my video's all over the place, I apologise. And he said, yeah, to be honest, we can just see your chest, but, you know, your shirt looks nice. And, you know, we kind of laughed it off and they totally understood why and it was all fine. But Now, I just find it just makes it a bit awkward for me, because then if people wonder why your video is all over the place and you've got to explain. So having something like this, you know, the Can You See Me app would have been fantastic at that point. It sounds really good.
Yeah, indeed. And of course, you know, as Ben said, you know, this was inspired by functionality that exists in the viewfinder on iDevices. So if you go into the camera and point the lens at your face, it'll tell you where you are in relation to the, you know, the edges, like top, middle, bottom, wherever. Is that something you do if you're doing video calls with your phone?
Video calls with the phone isn't something that I've really done, to be honest. Because, you know, whenever I'm on video calls, I don't often use FaceTime and things like that. So whenever I use video calls, it's always on a work situation. So, you know, it's always on my work PC or my work Mac. But it's good for, I do like that for general photos, though, that you've got on iOS. You know, it will say, like, there's two people in the frame, one face at the top and things like that. It is a good feature.
Would it give you a bit more confidence, Callum, maybe going into a meeting with people you don't know, if you could set it up, you know, ahead of time so that you knew you were going to be in the right place in the camera? Would you then be more inclined perhaps to switch your camera on in a meeting?
Oh, 100%, yeah. I'll definitely be having a play with this as soon as I can.
Yeah, I think I would find it reassuring as well, having just that information. I think it is a confidence thing, isn't it, that, you know, nobody wants to just be showing a picture of their chest with or without the shirt on.
Or the absolute mess behind me in my office.
Oh, I know. Oh, well, that's the other thing, you know, and I don't think this app is going to solve that problem, is it?
No, I'll have to do some tidying now.
Right, Callum Stoneman, we'd be interested to hear more as you get on with the app from Ben Mussel Rose. Can You See Me? Give it a whirl and let us know.
If you have a technology question, why not ask the Tech Talk team? Email now, techtalk@rnib.org.uk, or tweet RNIB Radio using the hashtag #AskTechTalk.
Gordon Anthony writes in and says, "Hi team, I'm so glad Tech Talk is back. Really loving the demos and interviews. You asked about navigation apps." You're right, we did. "So I thought I'd let you know my personal thoughts." So basically, Gordon is telling us that it's important to make a distinction between navigation apps and apps that tell you where you are.
It is an important distinction. So a navigation app would be sort of the sort of thing you get by default in Apple Maps or Google Maps, you know, where you've got your turn left at this street, turn right at this street.
He mentions he uses Good Maps, he uses Apple Maps. He said actually Google Maps is, Good Maps, he found it crashes sometimes for him. I've not had that problem. Have you tried Good Maps?
Good Maps is one of the ones that I haven't tried, to be honest, but I do want to, because I've heard a lot of good things about it lately.
So an orientation app, just explain how that might work.
So an orientation app is something that would give you a bit more, it's not particularly telling you where to go, it's more just keeping you on track. So it might be, if you've got, for example, I mean, Soundscape, I talk a lot about Soundscape, but that's my usual sort of go-to app. So if I need navigation, if I need something to be telling me to turn left or right, I would run, usually in my case, Apple Maps along with Soundscape. And then Apple Maps is giving me the directions. Soundscape is just giving me orientation. So it will occasionally prompt me and say, you're now on this street, or you're now at this crossing. Your destination is 200 meters away. And then later on, it might say your destination is 100 meters away.
So Gordon writes that he's tried Blind Square and he says it's good, but I find it a bit clunky and not the easiest app to use. Have you used Blind Square?
Yeah, I do love Blind Square. I personally find it okay, but it's one of them where I've used it for a long time. I mean, I've only recently sort of, I haven't even switched to Soundscape as such, to be honest. I still have Blind Square there. You know, sometimes it's better, sometimes it's not as good. The interface, yeah, I'd know what you mean. It's almost a bit too customizable. You know, there's just a massive list of options.
The thing I love about it is the ability to control it with the buttons on your earphones. So if you've got the Apple earphones that come with your phone, you know, the ones that have got the play pause button on the wire, you can start and stop music normally with that. You can control blind square with those controls. And I think that's really clever because you can sort of use it as a switch control to navigate the menu to get the information that you want.
It is, yeah. That is one of my favourite features about it, actually.
Gordon also mentions Lazarillo and says this is an excellent app to use when he's in a vehicle to keep him informed about what's around him, which streets nearby and junctions and so on. I guess you could also use that to figure out if a taxi driver is giving you the runaround as well.
Probably good, yeah. And Lazarillo is free as well, I believe, and that's cross-platform as well, so iOS and Android.
Yeah, so definitely lots to play with there. And if you're using navigation apps or any that we've not mentioned, in fact, do drop us a line. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Callum, thanks a lot. And Gordon, thanks for your email.
Let's return back to Dave's conversation with Richard Orme from the DAISY Consortium to learn more about accessible publishing.
Is there anything an individual can do if I want to read a book that I can't find in accessible format? What can I do? Have you got any advice?
Sure. So the first thing is that you will increasingly find, Dave, where you go shopping for ebooks, or indeed even if you go to a high street bookstore, as well as creating accessible books, publishers are indicating whether the titles that they're producing have accessibility in them. So the discovery of books that are accessible is becoming easier. In fact, from June 2025 in the EU, the ebooks that are sold in the EU will have to be accessible, and we'll need to know which ones are and aren't. It'll tell you whether or not those books are screen reader accessible, whether you can do things like make the text larger, whether images in there have been described, and so on. So that's on the positive side. If you encounter books where you're looking to receive an accessible version, what we ask publishers to do is to make sure that on their website they have contact details so that there's a smooth and easy process whereby one can reach out to the publisher and then they can provide an accessible version through a number of different routes. One of those routes is to provide the publisher file to an organisation like RNIB, who can then place it in their library or do some work to remediate that title and make it accessible. If publishers don't hear from customers, the customers that they're losing, then they won't know what they're missing out on. And whilst organisations like DAISY tell them that they can reach a larger market, hearing from customers that would like to buy their titles, but there isn't a suitable version available, that's a very powerful message. So that's certainly something that you should do to get access to your own book, but also get the message across to the publishers, who, as I mentioned earlier, in my experience, are really amenable to hearing this message and want to get their books into your hands.
You've been working in digital accessibility for, I want to say, most of your working life. Why have you dedicated so much time to this area? Why is it important to you, Richard?
Well, dedicated sounds like I'm a monk or something like that. I love it. I find it really stimulating. And the people working in the industry are brilliant colleagues. So it's not a hardship, Dave. You're one of those colleagues over the years. So take that as a bit of a compliment. Like many people with disabilities were part of my life. I grew up with an auntie who had multiple sclerosis, and I would try and come up with solutions that meant that she could do things like make phone calls on her own and call for assistance on her own. I grew up with a brother with Down syndrome and another brother with severe dyslexia. And my interest in technology was kind of interesting to them because we could see that this technology stuff was really going to help. I suppose the encounter that really set me on this path was when I was working at a college of further education back in the mid 80s. I was responsible for the computer technologies in the college, and I was told that one of the students who would be joining in the next week was blind and I needed to find a solution for him. Now, imagine what the talking technologies was like in the mid-80s. Dave, you were probably still in your nappy at that point, I'm guessing, but it was pretty crude. But again, because of his hard work and because we were able to get the technology work, that student went on to get his degree, qualify, and have a career in agriculture where he still works. And he is now a blind farmer with a successful farm. And I met him only last week again, so I'm still in touch. So it's the people and it's the technology. It's just a wonderful career in which to work. And I've seen the difference that these technologies can make for people to do whatever they're choosing to do with their lives.
Before we wrap up, I just want to kind of touch on quality, because accessibility isn't binary, is it? It's not black and white. It's not either accessible or it's not. Sometimes, you know, you can get a book where perhaps 90% of it is accessible, but actually the table or the bit that you really want to know about. I was looking at a book about marathon training recently. It will surprise you to hear. And the text was great. It was all, you know, very readable with my Braille display or my screen reader. Absolutely delighted. But then when I got to the kind of the training schedules, they were just kind of unlabeled images that had been kind of plonked in there. Where are we with technical content? You mentioned the student who managed to get a degree because information was made accessible, and clearly you know, STEM subjects are open to blind and partially sighted people, but that is reliant on our ability to access technical content. So how do we ensure quality and complete accessibility that, you know, people don't just sort of think, right, okay, the text reads with a screen reader, job done?
A student entering into further education these days, I hope, would have quite a different experience to Mike, who was the student I met back in 1986. And it is possible that publications have the text, maybe even headings and a good table of contents, but tables are images, images are undescribed. Maths formula, if they're in there too, maybe in as images. But we are working with the publishing industry to help them understand that that's not sufficient and that's not where the bar is. So when the EU Accessibility Act, which will impact UK publishers too, by the way, because UK publishers want to sell into that market, and so they're not going to make inaccessible titles in the UK and accessible ones for Europe, this is already having a big effect. We'll see the quality bar going up. So on those specific examples, that's being addressed, and we're seeing amazingly complex titles that are being adopted at university level, where the publishers are doing amazing jobs in not only describing images, but providing extended descriptions, providing all sorts of fantastic navigation and complementary learning resources too, that are accessible. But I think to the wider point around kind of quality, I've talked about accessibility experts and I've talked about publishers. But the other important part of this is, of course, people with print disabilities themselves being part of that conversation. And that's what we do at DAISY. We make sure that people understand that accessibility is not just a technical bar, that you can't check for accessibility just using automated tools. People with disabilities have to be involved in checking books and apps and these sorts of things. And of course, really employed within the industry themselves to further inform practice and so on. So, you know, quality is a kind of a thing that I think is an endless or rather a never ending goal to improve and find new solutions and do things that delight people even more. And that marathon training book, Dave, it would be lovely to work with you on making sure that the next edition of that is completely accessible to you and other people who follow in your running footsteps.
Richard Orme, thank you so much. Where can people find out more about the work of the DAISY Consortium?
Well, if they're interested specifically in accessible publishing, then two websites. One is nice and simple. It's daisy.org. Here you'll be able to read about the projects that we have, the technologies we have, and sign up for our newsletter, which is the DAISY Planet. If you know people who are working in publishing or you're interested in how the publishing industry is moving, then you can pop along to inclusivepublishing.org. That's the website that we've set up specifically to help publishers and for the publishers to talk with each other about making sure that the books they're producing don't have to have special versions, but can be made accessible from the day they're published. So it's the same book at the same time, at the same price, and in the same place. So it's available. You don't have to go to a special organization to get it. Inclusive publishing is a great place where you'll read case studies and articles, perspectives, and so on. So maybe pop along to those two places, Dave.
Richard Orme, thanks very much. That's it for this time on Tech Talk. Do tune in next week when we will be at Site Village, the exhibition of accessible products and services. And we'd really love to hear from you if you have been to a Site Village or any exhibition. In fact, how did you get on? What did you find? How was it? Drop us a line, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. But from myself, Dave Williams, Callum Stoneman, bye for now.
Bye from me.
And Tasneem Arshad. Bye for now.
Bye for now.